Hello, this is Tom Heck with TeachMeTeamwork.com, and on the phone with me today is John Taylor Gatto, who is, he doesn't realize it, but he's one of my heroes. As some of the people listening to this recording know, that I was a classroom teacher in 1990-91. I found out about John Taylor Gatto in 91 after I taught in a classroom. And I had read an article that it was a copy of a speech called The Six Lessons School Teacher. And reading that article, I started to really, that was sort of the beginning of what I, my path to really studying what it meant to be a teacher and what does it mean to learn. And so here we are in 2006, and I'm pleased to have John on the phone with us, and we're going to be talking today about teaching and learning. And a little background about John Gatto. He was a classroom teacher for 30 years in New York City. He won the New York State Teacher of the Year Award 3 different times. And he travels widely now, speaking on school reform and on these topics of teaching and learning. And so today we're going to be taking a closer look at that and hoping that you, the listener, you might be a classroom teacher, you might be a trainer in a corporate in a corporation, but one thing is for sure: if you, I think, if you understand what John Gatto has to share, you will be a better teacher because of it. John, I'd like to welcome you to the call.
Hey, thanks for having me, Tom.
Well, let's start at the beginning. What does it mean to be a teacher? And what does it mean, if you're a teacher, then you have students, and typically they might be, we can call them participants or students, or, and I'm guessing that most of the people listening to this recording have, virtually everyone has been through some kind of formal education, right, where it started in a classroom where there's a teacher at the front of the classroom. What's going on there? What is the, how do we start this discussion about what is teaching and what is learning?
Well, I think, to begin without exception, we're all teachers. Hmm. You can't escape it. Teaching isn't a profession, it's a function. And it's a function that all of us participate in, whether we will or not. What we have narrowed it down to mean is that in institutional forced schooling, you're hired and certified by a political state, but that almost guarantees that you're not much of a teacher. You're a relay transmitting basically what you're told to transmit. What all of us teach without being consciously aware of it is who we are and what we've made of ourselves as people, and to the extent that we show up radically incomplete, that we're not writing our own script through life or a large part of it, I think what we're teaching is that the world's a dangerous place, and you better find a patron to follow, or you're in trouble.
So what is it, if you were to advise someone on how to be a highly effective teacher?
Okay.
Where would you start?
There's only one way. There really is only one way.
Okay.
If you're going to be a highly effective teacher, mm-hmm, in the cosmic sense, you're going to be a highly effective human being.
Why do
you're
going to
be a highly effective human being in the institutional sense, it's rather easy to do. There's a set of tricks that will work for everybody, really. I mean, I'll just pick one at random out, is that your very best friend in discipline is humiliating the right people ahead of time, and maybe serving up the right sacrificial lamb at the right time. I hate to hear the tone of cynicism in my voice when I say that, but basically, if you're teaching in order to increase people's scores on standardized tests, you're involved in, I guess, one of the colossal scams of human history. The standardized tests do not measure anything except your ability to score well on the next. They predict your ability to score well on the next standardized test. They have a poor correlation, in some cases a negative correlation, with how well you'll be able to employ a particular skill. Let's take the computer industry,
okay,
for example. Microsoft, which has dominated for some years, is the creation of a college dropout who, in seeking a partner to found that organization, found a college dropout. Paul Allen had dropped out his freshman year. They set up and were successful in competition with Apple Computer, which is founded by a college dropout who sought out another college dropout, Steve Wozniak. Steve Jobs is the original one. Steve Wozniak, another college dropout, to found Apple. Both those companies were shocked when Michael Dell, a fellow who I believe had three college courses and dropped out with a term under his belt, founded Dell and sort of personalized the assembly of computers. Larry Ellison, the well-known head of Oracle, is a dropout his freshman year. The founder of CNN, Ted Turner, dropped out his freshman year. I mean, really could go on for quite a way. An enormous scam has been foisted on an ignorant public.
Now, is this the? I mean, we started off talking about teachers, and we've moved to the scam of teaching to the test score.
Well,
so what does it mean?
I do think that's a dominant idea at present. That if a school has falling standardized test scores, it's a bad school. If it has rising standardized test scores or high scores, it's a good school. And what I'm saying is both are irrelevant.
Mm.
They do measure something, but what they measure has no connection with mental development.
So in other words, what most of us think we understand about what it takes to be a good teacher, so I can imagine, let's say that there's someone listening to this recording who's a trainer at an organization, and they have really high test scores. Let's say they have a 4.0, graduating from high school, 4.0 graduating from college, and now they find themselves in the position of training other people. Their model has been test scores. If I can raise test scores, then I've done my job teaching.
Well, the difficulty, Tom, is that if someone's a trainer for a corporation, they don't really have very much latitude in interpreting what the corporation determines is a well-taught employee. We're talking about, I'll use a word with an edge in, but I don't mean it to be insulting. We're talking about someone producing an indoctrinated employee who won't deviate very far. After all, you can't have a system if the particles in the system reserve the right to think. It couldn't be 2 or 3 days when Lucy Kellaway's column, 2 or 3 days ago, Lucy Kellaway's column in Financial Times on the op-ed page basically said that if you want some sort of latitude and intellectual development, don't get yourself an executive spot in a corporation. And we're not talking about some leftist rag. We're talking about the Financial Times, which is quite conservative. She said that corporations can't tolerate people who think independently. Of course they can't. Well, that's not an indictment. I mean, if you ask me in a different show whether I would indict corporations for doing that, I'd say yes, but under the terms of their existence, they can't tolerate people who think. So if you're a trainer for a corporation, you want people who are reliable and predictable in their function. As a billboard on the side of, I think it was the Denver airport about 5 years ago, said, I remember smiling as I passed it. It was a nervous looking fellow standing by a fax machine or something, and the title was, "They don't want to know about your trip. They want to know, did you make the number?" And I thought about that, and I said, of course. Who cares who that human being is and all their hundreds of thousands of attributes? Did he sell the stuff or didn't he sell the stuff? That's right. What you want. Did he make the number?
Right.
Well, we've narrowed down our judgment of schools pretty much to, do they make the number? What I was trying to raise for consideration is, does the number have some organic relationship with anything else that we value? And the truth is, no. It does relate very, very closely as a measure of obedience. If you memorize what you're told to memorize, you will do well on standardized tests. And if you allow your mind to float into different regions and indifferently memorize, you won't do well on standardized tests. Once again, I'm really at some pains to keep the cynicism out of my voice because I'm far too old to talk politically or even polemically, but I do care about truth.
So what is the truth between the relationship between teaching and learning? How do we get there? I have a 7-year-old son, and we're headed down this path, and so this is in my face here. You said everybody's a teacher. Sometimes I'm working with my son, sometimes I'm out at a training event, and sometimes I have teachers coming to me saying, well, if a classroom teacher ends up at my website, oftentimes they're looking for team building exercises so that they can improve the community, the feel of the classroom, the sense of community. And why are they doing that? And it's usually related back to, will this improve test scores?
Well, we could enlarge it a little bit. The most prominent behavioral characteristic of a classroom is that it's compulsory. Is there such a thing as compulsory teamwork? I guess so. They got the pyramids built. If you're trying to operate on the basis of superior power, you can get some results. I guess why people try to transcend that particular relationship is it doesn't last, and as Hegel, the great German philosopher, taught us all 130 years ago, if you compel people, they will find a way to get even with you. Maybe not right away, but they will carry their resentment and create an antithesis to your thesis, and you're going to have a conflict of some sort, and you continue to have a conflict until you're overthrown by your adversary. Now, I mean, the great managerial heads of the Western world went to Hegel at the University of Berlin and studied there. I mean, we're talking also about the Carnegies and the Rockefellers, or they either studied directly or indirectly under someone who had studied under Hegel. If you're trying to have your cake and eat, if you're trying to compel people to follow your lead, and you think you can do that by sugarcoating, I think that you're inevitably going to be disappointed. There are ways to divide your opposition. I'd be happy as a good Italian to talk about the ways to cut the foundation out from under your opposition, so that the people who naturally resist you are eliminated by their fellows. I mean, you do that by selective bribery. That's what grades are in a classroom. Mm. That's what nice treatment is. That's why recognizing somebody's hand and ignoring somebody else's hand is. And there are ways to systematize that, but it really makes for an awful life for the person who does that. I mean, the beauty is that succeeding in creating a team through trickery or artifice carries with it its own exquisite punishment. I mean, you're not only a jerk, but you have a bad life. Your wife will leave you, your kids will betray you. It happens all the time. I think one of the difficulties is, but it's not a difficulty you've created, Tom, but it's something worth thinking about, is these questions are exquisitely complex, and they really all hover around an unstated question, is what's a good life? Mm. And how do I get there? Now, if it's getting a good paycheck and having the boss pat you on the head and you get in line for the promotion when he has his heart attack, you know, that's one thing. If you're trying to do what Thomas Jefferson said the only justification for schooling is, let me give you Jefferson's ideas. He said the only justification for compelling everybody to follow a course of instruction is to teach those people their rights. Now, there are four other things, but that's primary.
Mm.
Okay, I can't think of an organization that could survive. I certainly can't think of a school that could survive if people were taught their rights. With one exception, if they're taught their rights and they have no idea how to defend those rights, yes, then they'll remain as some disturbing abstraction. So Jefferson's second goal for schooling was to teach people how to defend their rights.
Hmm.
I mean, even 13-year-olds, who I spent my life with, can call on a whole variety of alliances to defend their rights. But could we have junior high school confinement if we taught them their rights and how to defend their rights? I don't think so. Then Jefferson's other bag of justifications were that a schooling should teach you to be self-determining, to write your own script and not be intimidated by experts. I mean, we're in a variety of wars right now that have bankrupted the country, destroyed the value of the dollar, and there's all the financial papers say there's a catastrophe just ahead.
Yes.
And I believe it will be one that will be colossal. But we got there by saying, well, the experts say we should do that. you know, what if all of those computer people who created the computer business had said, I guess I won't get anywhere unless I have at least one, and hopefully more than one, college degree, I don't think we'd have a computer industry. I'm quite serious.
Yes.
So the fourth reason is very interesting because it restores the, is it Jefferson's reasons for encouraging schooling. He said that, and this justifies, I think, an intense investment in the arts. It's a man who knows the ways of the human heart to such an extent that he can't be cheated or fooled. That's what great literature is, whether prose or nonfiction. It's some understanding of the human heart and the very wide field that it wanders in. And finally, Jefferson said that a school can be justified if it teaches useful knowledge. But what he meant by useful knowledge is something that everyone on the planet would agree, not something that's debatable, like how a bill becomes a law. Jefferson said you should not leave a school until you know how to build a house. You want teamwork. Look at all the various grassroots home building projects. Some of them have a little bit of national cachet, but there are a lot of them around. People don't have to be exhorted to cooperate. So how to build a house, how to build a boat, how to grow food, how to ride, how to hunt. You know, we could sit down over a pitcher of beer or tea, and we could probably come up with 50 things that everyone would agree. Well, then why are we wasting 12 years with nonsense? No bill ever became a law the way that schools teach that bills become laws. So why do they teach that? That's not a rhetorical question. I mean, it's really one that the parents who read your newsletter ought to ask themselves. There's not a mystical reason that defends the expenditure of a chunk of your kid's time. You have to clearly understand what it is, or someone has to be able to clearly explain to you what it is, or you ought to fight like the Dickens to see that your kid's time isn't wasted that way, nor should you waste your kid's time that way. After all, I mean, we all have this finite amount of time on Earth, this finite amount of time when it's reasonably safe to stick your neck out and take risks. And it ought to be treated like something precious.
So help me get to a place where I can be a better teacher. I get that what I want my students or participants or whatever we want to call them, let's just call them students, depending on the format someone's teaching in, we might call them different things. But I let's say that I really want to be a better teacher.
Sure.
I want to know how I can do that, because I've got all this framework of what I think is a good teacher, and I hear what you're saying, that essentially it sounds to me like you're saying is that I've been indoctrinated both as a teacher and I've been indoctrinated as a student to essentially toe the line. So, and I hear what you're saying, that you want that I you mentioned being obedient, and we need to teach people how to think freely. I know that Tom Peters, who's many of our listeners know, is, you know, wrote a book called In Search of Excellence years ago, and is a proponent of finding people who are just what you're saying, that, you know, think differently, ask different questions. So how can I do that as a teacher? How can I help?
Well, fortunately, throughout Western history, probably throughout the history of all the societies on Earth, but certainly throughout Western history, there have been major benchmarks established. The difficulty is, and the confusing thing for people who more or less expect their schools to be up on this and to administer it, is that what institutional schooling was established to do and what an education is according to these benchmarks are they just took different roads. So maybe the easiest thing to start with is why we have schools this way. I will not suggest in any course of this, in case you hear a vagrant tone in my voice, that a whole lot of bad people did this.
Okay.
The people who did this clearly weren't school teachers. They weren't school principals or superintendents. They weren't, in fact, people who had anything to do with schooling. And notice that today, on no blue ribbon panel, is this anyone who came through teaching or school administration sit, period. It doesn't happen, even though it's the largest employer in the United States and far and away the most expensive part of our social organization. I mean, far and away, twice the Defense Department size, at least twice. No one's invited. None of the people who are visible have anything to do with school being the way it is. So that when you can now spare yourself, I hope at least some of you, the endless debates about if we could only get a good superintendent in here.
Mm.
The difference between a good superintendent and a bad superintendent is so minuscule that you may as well put your energy elsewhere. There, if I were to use a harsh term, everyone in the school business, all the millions, they're all flunkies. Some of them are wonderful flunkies, that is to say, they sabotage the system they're a part of. And in doing that sabotage, some people escape the meshes, through the meshes of the net. But by and large, that doesn't happen because production, in one way, in the form of standardized test scores, is closely monitored. And if there are any weird deviations, I can guarantee you that the FBI or some similar organization will be Johnny on the spot. That includes if you have a ghetto class and they suddenly appear at the top of the standardized test scores, higher than elite high school test scores. You can count on the fact that there will be long hearings, not applauding the people who caused that, but making sure it doesn't happen again. Schools were given six precise functions right around the turn of the century, and why they got those functions at the, and I will go through them, but why they got those functions at the time they did is very, very easy to see if you have the slightest interest in American history. Somewhere after the American Civil War, which has to be the worst single event, not just in loss of life, but destructive of our original founding charter. I mean, slavery would have been dead all by itself inside of a decade or two afterwards. And high-level historians have understood this for 50 years. The Civil War was about eliminating the effective opposition in Congress to certain undertakings of the government. But we'll say that for another time. After the Civil War, two things happened. The rise of fossil fuel in connection with machinery and the perfection of the steel making process led to a position where far-sighted people like John D. Rockefeller or Vincent Astor or Andrew Carnegie, probably another two dozen and a few hundred more of their flunkies, could see that the problem of production had been solved. The thing that had plagued every society in human history had been solved. Unfortunately, the United States had this habit. It was already being solved in Germany, in England, to some extent in France, by employing people as machine parts in conjunction with coal or oil fuel-driven machinery. You could now produce unlimited amounts of stuff, power. But the United States had this tradition, probably best understood by from a speech given by Abraham Lincoln in 1859 to the Wisconsin Agricultural Association. Excuse me for hesitating, but I've reached an age where I have to punch buttons in my head and hope that the stuff comes out. Lincoln said in 1859 to the Wisconsin Agricultural Association that the British had invaded the United States and were financing our move westward. But to do so, they were bringing in the corporate ideal, and they were saying that it's not economical to waste resources or worry on the people who run these machines. That Darwin had already established, here's the main reason that Darwin's taught in every school in the world, that Darwin had already established that only a few people were evolving. And that's true. Of course, you have to actually read what he wrote rather than what a school tells you that he wrote. Only a few were evolving, and all the rest of the people on Earth were evolutionary dead ends. And if they were to corrupt the evolving fraction, that evolution would march backwards. If people are the slightest bit dubious, you want to pick up a book that I guarantee you will be in every library in the United States called Descent of Man, published here in 1871 and kept continuously in print. And if you happen to have any Irish in your background, I guarantee you that your impulse will be to get down to your local public school and demand that Darwin be thrown out of the library, because he says the Irish are biologically corrupted and they will cause evolution to march backwards if the good stuff. That was but he had saved his particular wit for the Irish.
And now just we started down this path because I wanted to know how
I'm giving you the justification for doing this the way it's done.
Okay.
If you start with an attitude that most people are evolutionary retards, anything you can do to protect the biologically advanced material, anything you can do is quite morally acceptable. You're furthering the cause of the improvement of the human race.
Now, this sounds like sort of a X Factor, you know, the TV series of like a dark secret happening.
The problem with not understanding how these things got to be the way they are is that all reform ends up being futile, Tom, because it will have to be done over and over again. This template will restore itself the minute that the furor, the social furor about school reform dies down. I mean, we've had 7 major school reforms in the last 100 years, and every one of them ended up with school being larger, more expensive, and more in command of the time of the young. And there are powerful reasons for this.
Okay.
So now what you've given the, let me say, the managerial class of the new corporations is a mandate to not only enrich the corporation, which is capitalist theory, that's okay, but in fact to help the human race by eliminating the possible obstacle that, you know, the biologically unfortunate will cause.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of the major corporate heads in the turn of the century was a committed Darwinist. And what that means is not that they said, oh, now we know how from single-celled animals. No, it means that they finally had a purpose. They had given up the purpose of being God's children. Okay, but then what do you do with your time if you have everything? You've got to have some, what is the newest hot underground book? Purpose-driven life.
Yeah, right.
And what is a purpose that's worthy of Andrew Carnegie turning his attention to it? Well, improving the human race. That ought to be on a scale with United States Steel. Okay, so huge amounts of foreign labor were brought in. They didn't come here yearning to be free the way they were brought here. They were recruited in Europe by teams and who got bounties for loading up the ships and unloading them, and you drove the independent livelihood almost off the field. You finished the job by specializing so that most specialists can't work unless they're contracted. If they're left on their own, there's no neighborhood work for them.
Now, you're telling me about the history?
No, I'm telling you that the school's the way it is because it dovetails in 100 subtle ways with the kind of economy we have. If you were to change the form of schooling, for example, as a homeschooler,
yes,
you told me you were going to be homeschooling your two kids, you'll make radical changes in your kid's consciousness. You may not set out to do that, but it will happen. Your kid will be more adventurous, more independent, more curious, probably competent in a variety of areas rather than on a narrow compass. And by doing that, you'll probably, if there aren't too many of you, escape and doubtless make a better psychological life for your kid, and probably a better material life. But if a tipping point were reached, you would and will collapse the existing economy, and when that's done, there will be a long period of hideous chaos. It won't just suddenly become, you know, this better type of economy where people have independent livelihoods. So Lincoln told the Wisconsin Agricultural Association that everybody, that the American dream wasn't to get rich, he said, it's to have an independent livelihood. And that's quite true. I just spoke at an entrepreneurs convention out in California. And I said, it's probably fun to be rich or famous. I wouldn't know, but it probably is. But that's not where the game is. The game is disposing your own time. You only have the same finite amount of it that I do or anyone else does. You know, to give it to someone else to spend is essentially to say, I'll give you my life in exchange for 3 squares and a flop. It's a bad trade. Hmm. It's a bad trade. Bad trade for an accountant, and it's a bad trade for a
factory worker. So here we have
the
system that is it seems like what you're saying is that it's not designed at all to create independent thinking people.
Oh, quite the reverse.
Okay.
It can't survive with those people.
So now, so here you are, an educator working inside that system, or you've since grown up and graduated and you're working inside a corporation, or and you were working with, we're essentially training people or teaching people who are still inside this system.
My own self-definition after I became sufficiently aware of the harm I was causing, my own self-definition was as a saboteur. I couldn't and nor am I advocating that anybody reading what you put out on the internet ought to do this, but my own solution was to make the system work poorly and to free as many people as I could. I knew that standing on a soapbox and shaking my fist, that the system had defenses against that. But I also knew that there were contradictions, human contradictions in the system, that I could work silently and cause the system to go haywire. And in those moments of maximum systematic confusion, I would have a field in which to educate.
So what does that mean to you when you say that you had a field to educate?
Well, you got to start with, like, once again, you have to start with a definition of what you mean. No dictionary definition is anything other than meaningless, but there are, as I said 15 minutes ago, there are benchmarks, major benchmarks in human history, and maybe we can touch some of them.
Okay.
I won't give you a comprehensive palette, but let's touch a few of them. I should confess that I got a lot of the ideas that were useful to me by studying the way that elite private boarding schools operated. Not private schools, elite private boarding schools. There are about 300 of them in the country, and there are only 20 or 25 that really matter. The other 275 take their marching orders from the inner 25. And so I said, why don't I just get the catalog from each of these schools, get what supplementary reading I can from the public library, and cast my net and try to get some interviews with people who had gone through this training. And it was a revelation to me. I did this work 30, 40, probably by the fifth year I was a school teacher, and I taught for 30 years. And I quickly saw that nothing that Groton or Hotchkiss or Andover or Lawrenceville, nothing that they did that was effective cost a penny. That I could adapt every one of the major principles instantly and apply them to Harlem kids. And I was very curious, because school teaching, as I hope you find out, is incredibly boring once the furor dies down, you know,
yeah.
The excitement of people throwing things at your head and you're being threatened by your colleagues and stuff. So one of the things I noticed that I got independent confirmation of once I had it was that there was an intense concentration on what used to be known as the active literacies. The very fact that the term has fallen out of popular understanding ought to raise some pretty serious suspicions, because for the first 200 years of American history, everybody knew that there are three literacies, not one, and that the reading literacy was the servile literacy, that you had to be taught to read so that the boss could go and play golf and leave a list of what you had to do. You had to be taught to read, but that's the passive literacy. The active literacies are the way that you take your own script and recruit allies, either by speaking or writing. The only way you can become dangerous is if you're trained in the active literacies. But let's put the good face on it. The only way you can be an effective human being, for the most part, is to have some mastery of the active literacies. Otherwise, you can't take a role as a citizen in the society. So I've been traveling now for 15 years, nearly 3 million miles. I have yet to see a public school, or most private schools, who waste any time, really, on writing or public speaking. Oh, they make lip service, I mean, perfunctory nods. But an intense program to create an effective speaker with any kind of audience, give me a break. How could you run a school if you had people who could defend their rights? We're back to Thomas Jefferson.
Right.
There. So
and even writing, you know, the three R's, they say. So writing is, you still say that, not really emphasized.
It's not only not emphasized, but nobody can train you to be a great writer, but you certainly can be trained to be a very good writer and a very effective writer and an interesting writer. I mean, these are mechanical tricks.
Right.
And I was able to master the mechanical tricks and apply them to Harlem kids. You know, I didn't have time to waste on spelling, unfortunately, but if I respelled their papers, they were winning major writing awards all over the city, which got me in a tremendous amount of trouble. They were publishing things for money in New York newspapers, etc. And anyone could be taught these things quickly. Nor is there any resistance to learning them. You know, but a society with people actively trained has only occurred a couple of times in human history. One of them, if your readers, your subscribers, will spend a couple of hours, no more than that, pick up the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin. Mm-hmm. I mean, written 150 years ago and continuously in print. It's only 100 pages long. The language is quite simple. Read it, and you should be two things: astounded at your own ignorance, or my own ignorance, about what a 12-year-old kid's capable of. I mean, Franklin and his friends were putting themselves through a curriculum in between working 60 hours a week at hard labor, putting themselves through a curriculum that I guarantee you that Harvard, Yale, and Princeton wouldn't dream of asking their freshmen or sophomores to go through. Nor did these ignorant bumpkins, I mean, Franklin's from a family of, I don't know, 15 or 16, and father's a candle maker. It's decent work, but, you know, you don't go to Club Med on a candle maker's income. Nor did they think it was particularly out of the ordinary or unusual to do. And if you read between the lines in Franklin's autobiography, you'll see that the Philadelphia of the middle 18th century was a society that mixed all ages together in this exciting electric ferment Franklin goes to Europe a couple of times on his own before he's 18, you know, to seek opportunity there. And nor was it out of the ordinary to do that. We've accepted hook, line, and sinker, a very limited palette of colors to paint our lives with.
So do you like the term empowerment?
I despise all jargon terms, because they quickly, although at the moment they're created, you know, they probably illuminate something, very quickly they just become some routine din in your ears.
An effective teacher is not someone who empowers people, you think?
I think an effective teacher inspires kids by his or her own example to educate themselves. Nobody on earth can educate you. It isn't possible. You educate yourself. Someone can school you, and they can punish you if you show that you're imperfectly schooled by low test scores. No one can educate you except yourself. One of the huge differences between the elite private boarding schools and all the rest of the mass is that they shift the burden of responsibility to the student. 90%. I mean, you go into a public school class and 90% of the work, the notes on the board, the test questions, the corrections, you know, the timing, 90% of the work's done by the teacher. You've got to shift that responsibility. So on these benchmarks in history, the act of literacies is a major benchmark. You'd know that by the fact that it was a serious crime to teach ordinary people in British America, in colonial America, a serious crime to teach ordinary people the act of literacies. In Virginia, I used to memorize the statute, but I'm sorry to say that advancing age, or maybe advancing sanity, I've forgotten it. You're not allowed to teach people that, and you're not allowed to teach them that today. However, those things are rather simple to teach yourself if you know that nothing is remotely as important as that. Or you're trapped inside yourself. You're a victim for the rest of your life if you're unable to recruit allies.
Well, and looking at the time, we're coming up on an hour, and you've been very generous. I'd love to get another benchmark. And
let me give you another benchmark. This
yes.
comes from prior to the Christian era, Aristotle. There's a name that everybody knows, although, you know, not too many people bother to read him, even though he's quite a clear writer. I think it's the Politics. Aristotle basically says that if you can't think dialectically, you're not really a human being at all. You know, you're some transitional stage between, you know, some animal or a creature and a human being. Well, the dialectic is quite teachable. Once again, no school or corporation could run with dialectically trained people. People who can hold in suspension what they're told is the truth and test it against a variety of the probably the most famous dialectic is Marx's, but there are lots of different ones. That what you're offered by any authority is a thesis. This is the way things are. Now, a simplistic way to create the dialectic is to instantly repudiate whatever you're told is and say, that can't be true. School is good. No, school is bad. Now, at that point, and this is a measure of your stamina and your intelligence, you start marching back from the antithesis, trying to use your own experience and reflection and figure out at exactly what point between school is good and school is bad the truth lies, but that it never lies in the thesis or in the antithesis is a huge breakthrough in thinking. I'll leave that go, although we could spend an hour on that. Now I'll jump to another one that comes to us from Francis Bacon at the beginning of the 17th century. He's a contemporary of Shakespeare. And Bacon sees that, I don't mean this to be deliberately mean, he sees that scholastic thinking, that was a technical term, Thomas Aquinas, let's say, scholastic thinking leads to a kind of moribund inventive life, and that scholastic thinking, where you think deductively, has to be replaced. And he, in a book called Novum Organum, which is really a long essay rather than a book, Bacon says that the inductive method will lead to endless discovery. Well, the inductive method has written the world, you and I and anybody reading this live in. And the inductive method is that you don't start with premises, you start with close observation and the recording of data, and you don't bring any pre-thought thoughts to that. You simply collect facts in abundance, material facts, and then what Bacon says will happen is, and of course it always happens, these facts will organize themselves into categories, and then by figuring out the relation between these various categories, what time of day or what air temperature that these things occur, principles will suggest themselves, new principles of how nature works. And you can test these principles, and if they pass a certain number of these tests, you can confidently say that you can freeze food, keep it for 5 years, and you won't drop dead when you eat it. I mean, I just picked that one out of the air.
Okay.
So that inductive method, which ought to be applied in every school subject, including math from time to time. I mean, math largely deductive, but this inductive method, when practiced for a few years, two or three, that alters the way you see everything. Everything is constantly subject to your critical intelligence. And you can spot liars very easily. You can spot contradictions in what other people sincerely believe, and you can say there has to be a different explanatory theory because these contradictions wouldn't exist if the one that's widely accepted is so.
Well, I'd like to wrap up with just your view of the impact of the teacher's character, and there.
It really is everything.
So tell me.
Emulation is the word you want. A teacher teaches by what he or she has made of themselves, and that's unmistakable to even to ignorant children. I once took a girl aside who really was a holy terror, age 13. And when the other kids left the room, I said, listen, I'm really curious. I said, you swing through the chandeliers, you tear this whole school apart. If we had five kids like you, the school wouldn't run. I said, but you don't give me any trouble, and I want to know why. I'm really curious. And she said, you talk to everybody the same way. I said, what do you mean? she said, well, she said, you look at these people. They talk to one class one way, another class another way. They talk to the fellow teachers another way. If an administrator comes to the door, they talk another way. When a mother comes in, they talk another way. They're hypocrites, she said. You can't believe anything they say. I think she said they were two-faced. She said, you talk to everybody the same way. And it's true. I mean, it's true because that's my habit, because I came from that a part of the country where I guess that was valued. I've never given it much thought.
But I
quickly saw that worthwhile human beings who really loved the kids were being cut to pieces because they had memorized principles they learned in teacher college, you know, and they had made themselves hypocrites. The kids knew that. Kids also know that when you make promises that you can in a classroom, that you can't deliver on those promises because you're owned by other levels of the bureaucracy, the system. So
character is everything, and
I would say it's everything.
And
you have
even adults, I guess. In a, you mentioned kids can see right through this, and I'm in agreement with you. I've worked a lot with kids, and I've worked when I worked with juvenile delinquents. One of the things I loved best was they not only saw through it; they would tell me right then and there in my face, in no uncertain terms, what was wrong with me.
Right, and you often can learn from
them. I did, and so, real quickly, I mean, it seems like maybe just try to just say personal development. That's what you got to do. So, how does one?
You have to have a life. The kids quickly, they ask little elliptical questions, but what they're trying to add up is whether you're a person or not. I think sons and daughters do that with their own parents all the time. They may not be aware that it's a strategy, but it's employed as a strategy. And if you come up with a hollow person, you know, who has no particular interest, no particular beliefs that aren't amenable to, you know, pressure, isn't that the rap we often have against our politicians? I was about to name some, but I won't. I won't. That they have no character.
Right. And so you've got to have a life. And people see, I guess what you're saying is that if you're in an instructional role,
you teach who you are,
and your students
people
want
will
to
learn
see.
From you. If they respect who you are, they may memorize what you have to say.
Yeah.
If they see you as an obstacle in the path of them, you know, getting a raise or a paycheck or whatever.
Right.
But they'll learn from you if they believe you're real.
Hmm. So that, and then finally, I'd just like you to comment on trust. It seems like, as you've shared your thoughts with me today and our listeners, is that trust plays a huge role in what you're suggesting.
Huge. The minute that you've lost trust, in a classroom setting, you don't ever get it back. It can't be bought back. So,
but you trust the student, too. You believe, you trust that they know what to do.
I trust that they know what to do for themselves.
Right.
Sometimes I would use my much longer experience being alive to say, look, what you want to do for yourself, let me be specific rather than generic here. So you see a kid who never does anything in class except draw comic books.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of going back and saying that has its place and this has its place, you go back and you say the third leading employer in New York City is some aspect of the graphic arts. So you're on a good track here. But unfortunately, you've not trained yourself in how to do that. I can see by look, because you're copying from a comic book, and it's not even remotely like what's in the comic book. I said, why don't you take a week off school? I'll cover for you. Go to the public library. I'll give you a letter. Put 30 books on graphic arts down on the table and learn what you're doing. I don't know if how many of your subscribers read comic books, probably not too many. But one of the things that's common in a comic book is that the panels in which the little characters perform are all different shapes. And what you get with a kid who can't actually see the world around him is that they'll draw all the panels the same size. And what you'll see very commonly on every page is that the characters inside the panel frequently stick their head out of the panel or their hand or their foot out of the panel. It's a way to capture movement and dynamics. But the kids will contain all their characters tightly inside the panel. You know how quick it is to change that? Just pointing it out, and suddenly the kid sees what a disparity there is between what his eyes are recording and what's actually there. That's valuable stuff. You know, now push it to the next level and become good at it. You know, no upper class education, I haven't kept up for the last 20 years, was ever complete without intense courses in drawing. That wasn't an artistic embellishment. If you can't draw what your eyes see, then you're not actually seeing what's out there. There's a severe skew between the way you interpret these visual stimuli, you know, and what's the test that if somebody else can recognize what you've drawn. Not naturally, we virtually eliminate drawing from the classroom, even though it's a staple of upper class education. And Darwin would never have published Origin of Species if it weren't for the thousands of drawings in it that
yeah.
carried his argument.
Right. Well, okay, so here I want to wrap up the conversation, and I've been speaking with John Taylor Gatto, and I'd like to share with people how can they learn more about what you're doing. Of course, you've got your website, johntaylorgatto.com. Is G-A-T-T-O.
Well, I would say that the underground history that I wrote, which took 10 years, I mean around the clock, 6-7 days a week, Underground History of American Education, that's available for sale on my website, is the distillation of 30 years teaching and 10 years thinking. The passion that stimulated the writing of that book is in the book I wrote immediately after I quit teaching, Dumbing Us Down. So they're like bookends.
Yeah.
One is a short book, one is a very, very long book, 330,000 words. But what they catch is the passion and some of the confusion why this should be as it is. And at the other end, breaking out of the trap would be the chapter that offers a kind of menu of options.
And of course, you travel and speak frequently, it seems, and I know you're traveling around the world soon.
I'll be going to Las Vegas and southern Utah next week, and then I believe, although my wife will have to verify this, I go to Australia for 6 weeks, so I'm going to 11 different places in Australia. I go to Pakistan and then to Paris. And if that sounds like a good schedule, then you must be 25 or 30 years old. That's all I can say.
Well, I think that I want our listeners to realize is that there are opportunities around the world to see John Gatto speak.
If anybody wants to have me out, you could put my phone number down, although you can reach me through my website, but somebody else watches it, and he's peddling the Tour de France course right now.
Yes.
So where I am right now is 607-843-8418, or my fax is a pretty reliable way to reach me. It's in New York City, but I check it out every 10 days. That's 212-721-6124.
Okay.
And if I get a second lifetime, I promise to get email back.
Well, this recording will be out over the internet and being shared with people around the world, and I think that your message is applicable to parents, to teachers who are in a classroom environment, to educators or trainers in a corporate environment, to whoever is in front of people trying to get them to understand how to do something or teach them. So I just want to thank you for sharing your time with us today.
Well, I had a lot of fun, and I wish you luck. And can you send me a copy?
I certainly will.
Are you able to cut a CD?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Well,
our paths will cross again. I'll buy the first beer.
Well, this is Tom Heck with TeachMeTeamwork.com. We've been talking with John Taylor Gatto, and you can find him on the web at johntaylorgatto.com. His last name is G-A-T-T-O, and you can find his books, and there are next to this article, or I'm sorry, this recording, there will also be links to other writings of John's that are available. He's written prolifically on education and learning and teaching, and I've learned a tremendous amount from him. So, again, thanks for listening to this recording, and look forward to another conversation, perhaps at some point, with John Gatto. Thank you.